Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Kurzweil podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is the man of
Joel.
hour, with an
Joel,
air of
Joel.
Great power, Joel.
What? Oh.
I'm doing one of the dumb song lyric things.
What, from the Rickshaw Man? I don't remember that.
It's a Kurt Mayfield song.
Oh, well, there you go. So I'm like Superfly.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I deal with
you
that.
Got... you're my mama and my daddy. Yeah, you're nigga in the alley. Never mind.
What?
Listen to the lyrics.
No, that's all right.
You have coke and some weed.
Yeah, I know that lyric.
Oh wait, sorry, I got mixed up for another song. Anyways,
it's because you're that's the Pusher song.
Yeah, right? Pusher Man. That's the one that's better.
Yeah,
it is.
So the Rickshaw Man song is pretty good though.
I don't remember the song.
There was no Rickshaw Man song.
Okay.
Don't worry. I was just thinking that it could have had one. Until the ending came around. Spoiler. Then all of a sudden you don't want any sort of Rickshaw Man song.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is the final pairing of the... Final pairing. This is the
second half?
Yeah. It's not the last episodes. This is the second half of 1958. We just did Hidden Fortress, so now we are on the second part. And this is kind of a Toshiro Mifune-centric pairing, because he is the big star in lights in both.
He's inescapable when it comes to well-known Japanese cinema anyways. I mean, it's especially, obviously, Kurosawa. Every other one is probably going to have Toshiro Mifune on it. But he did a lot of other roles for a lot of other people. And I saw some other familiar faces in this movie, too. Like the guy that's always in the Ozu movies.
Oh, Chichiru? Ryo?
Yep, Chichiru. And there was a part where where Mifune's character was at a bar. And I know that bartender looked extremely familiar. And I just...
I know what you're talking about. I think that might have been the priest from Lower Depths, maybe?
It's possible. He's got a face of something, I've seen.
Because he's a
period piece.
Yeah, he's a Kurosawa guy. I'm just not sure what movies.
Yeah, I don't see anyone specifically listed as, like, the bartender. And I wonder if there's a way we can, like, go on to IMDb and add photos for all these people. Because I feel like if I saw their photo, I'd know who they were, because I'm not going by their name.
Isn't it, you add, like, Wikipedia, basically?
Oh, see, I'm not on Wikipedia. Oh, you mean IMDb?
Yeah. Or do you...
I'm not sure. Oh. I'm not, like, some things are, like, locked down, so you can't edit any details and stuff like that. I'm not sure how that works, especially with, like, photos of celebrities, which is what this would be in that case.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the reference photo usually has to be done by whatever company is in charge of their likeness.
Let's see. So, do you want to compare the two movies first or go over the plot first?
Well, let's start with the director here, guy.
Oh, yeah. This is the first film of... I almost said Inarritu, because I just watched
The Revenant?
Yes. Which is good, but those fucking accents I can't understand.
I haven't seen it.
You can't understand Tom Hardy.
It's funny that Tom Hardy now has at least two movies where you can't understand what he's saying.
In The Dark Knight Rises, I could hear him perfectly, and I knew what he was saying, but this one...
Right, because they... I mean, because they redid his audio, but...
This one's like... What's a southern accent?
Oh, so he's like Boomhauer?
Yeah, and it's a song sounds like he always has, like, tobacco in his mouth, so it's... Yeah, I can't understand what anything he says.
Them fur trappers.
Yeah. And you get Domhnall Gleeson in it, and he's really good.
I like that guy.
And Freya was barking at him when he was on screen.
Well, he is a scumbag, probably.
Anyway.
You're talking about Inagaki, Hiroshi Inagaki.
Yes, he did the Samurai Trilogy. He did an adaptation of 47 Ronin, It's not his First Time Ronin is only 3 hours compared to Mizoguchi's 4 hours.
Yeah, I must have seen Mizoguchi's then, because the one I watched was split into two hours each.
I think Toshiro is in the Inagaki one, too. I gotta check. And for some reason, I'm thinking Setsuko Hara is in it, because she was in some of his stuff, too.
Let me see real quick. Let's see. Inagaki, Seven Samurai. Wait, 47 Samurai plus an additional 40. What the hell? Definitely Toshiro Mifune, Tatsuya Mihashi, Setsuko Haro. Yes, she is also in it.
Mm-hmm. We probably should cover that one at some point. Or compare
the two versions. Well, it's 1962, so... Oh, yeah, we could do a special 47 Samurai thing where we watch all three of the movies.
All three? Oh, okay.
Yeah, the one for the 40s, the one from the 60s, and the goddamn one that Keanu Reeves did.
Yep.
I'm sure there's more adaptations than that, too, but, you know.
So, yeah. Inagaki is mainly famous for epic samurai films. Primarily.
Yeah, so Rickshaw Man is, or Muhumatsu the Rickshaw Man compared to Hidden Fortress. I guess we could say that they do have, you know, peasantry interacting with people who have more money. That's a pretty typical theme in Japanese movies, though, so...
Yeah, it's not that special.
Yeah.
They're
both...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I say, like, stylist, like, in terms of, like, story and scope, they are complete opposites.
What do you mean?
One is, like, a big epic adventure, and the other one is this, like, more...
more personal.
More personal, more quiet drama about a rickshaw man.
Yeah, but they are both comedy dramas. Like, there's a lot of funny stuff in Hidden Fortress, and Rickshaw Man has funny parts. Although, man, let me tell you, that, once again, skipped to the end there. That ending basically spoiled the whole thing for me.
What? How so?
We'll get to it when we get to it.
Okay.
Yeah. What else?
Toshiro's performances are very different.
Yeah.
Who is it?
He really does embody characters, different characters. Although I feel like I've seen him play a character like the Rickshaw Man in other things, but you know, it's almost more like his Yojimbo character, except no, that's not true. It's more like...
Well, yeah, your Jumbo is definitely more quiet than his typical Kurosawa characters.
Right.
I don't know, this one was very, like, heartfelt and, like, sensitive for him.
Yeah.
Which I know he is capable of, but I haven't seen him, like, that's his main, like, trait of the whole movie, that he's, like, this surrogate father instead of...
Well, yeah. I think of a Wedding Ring. You know, he's sensitive in that movie.
Oh, yeah. I forgot we did that. He's the doctor.
Mm-hmm. And, let's see. I'm thinking of Rashomon, which we actually haven't watched for the podcast yet. But, you know, there's several different scenes where he has to play different versions of the same character. And he, you know, sometimes he's acting crazy over the top like he was in Rickshaw Man. And then, but he's, you know, he is a peasant in that movie, so he's doing that thing going on the whole time.
Okay, the bartender is Bokuzen Hadari.
Uh-huh.
He's the former Yohai in Seven Samurai. He is the priest guy in Lower Depths.
Right.
And he's going to show up in a couple more movies. Ikaru, which is very good, and Redbeard.
I'm going to make it my mission to see if I can get photos of these people on IMDb, because I think it's important. It should be. I mean, why wouldn't it be up there? You don't just forget about these actors just because they don't have representation.
Yeah.
I'm taking a stand. I got a lot of passion in my blood right now.
Side note, did you see about the Arrow releasing early Suzuki stuff?
Yes, I did see that, yeah. I might be getting some money soon, and let me tell you, I need some media. I need some physical media in my life.
Yeah, I knew you'd like it. I'll probably watch one or two and be like, I am still not on board with his early stuff.
Right. I'll find a way to get you some of that, you know, so you can at least take a peek.
Well, I was hoping it would be like his late era stuff that's hard to find in the West, but nope.
Oh, you never know.
Yeah, maybe eventually, but still I haven't seen his like later stuff be easily available for over here.
Yeah, I don't know if people who aren't like total film nerds are aware of like the good work that people like Arrow Video, mm-hmm. like Severn Films, like Mondo and even Drafthouse Films mm-hmm. are doing other like people that I'm totally forgetting the name of because they're small companies that do small releases, but they're of mm-hmm. these movies that are like mostly forgotten, you know, or that people have the copies have deteriorated in such a way that it's almost less cost effective to even bother trying to do it, but they mm-hmm. do it because it's like they're movies that were made. People should see them, whether they're good, bad, terrible, well known, unknown, you know.
Yeah,
like with the exception of there was one I heard about recently that they're probably never going to do. Never mind, I can't remember.
No. Yeah, some horror movie. Xenon Pictures, another one. Mm-hmm. They do old exploitation stuff. They released on DVD, I think it's Melvin Van Peebles' first film, the one he did before Sweetback, that I watched 10 minutes of on Fandor. I was like, nope, this is irritating.
Yep.
But they still like have like released early Melvin Van Peebles stuff that is thought to be like gone forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Vinegar Syndrome, that's another one that does stuff like that. They do things more like Van Nuys Boulevard and other grindhouse movies that your pals probably are into.
Oh, it's a grind bin?
Uh-huh.
Crown International.
Yeah. All the Crown International specials.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's talk about The Rickshaw Man.
Yeah.
1958.
Yeah, so basically, if you got off on a tangent, listeners, there's not much comparison with these two movies?
Well, one more thing I wanted to say is that both of these movies are very cinematic, and that sounds, I mean, that's a cheap word to throw out when you're trying to say a big thing. I just mean that they are presented in a way that I feel like to wow the audience. You know, we talked about The Hidden Fortress being the first widescreen that Kurosawa did, mm-hmm. and that is just a visually stunning movie. This movie is presented, you know, in full color, and there are so many of these transitions and mm-hmm. like flashbacks that happen. The rotating wheel of the rickshaw used to represent, you know, transitions in time and stuff like that, and like beautiful fireworks. They did a real job on you know, making it visually beautiful.
Yeah, it's it definitely is a well-made movie. Yeah, I do want to see more in Inagaki now.
Yeah, me too. I'll have to line something up, like you said.
Although, it's kind of interesting that just on accident we picked The Outlier.
Yeah, you're looking for... We had to find something for 58.
Yeah.
What was the other one we were considering?
Ozu. But
oh, yeah, another Ozu.
There's so much other Ozu that we can do, that we can save if there's nothing else.
Right, and we're going to be doing this podcast for another year at least, so...
Yeah.
Or longer, who knows?
Yeah, so...
And then just on this director, so we'll find out.
A spoiler alert, there will be a Setsuka Hara special episode, which will be an excuse to watch basically all her Ozu stuff.
Yeah.
In the future, I don't know when, but it will happen.
I know you guys are waiting with bated breath. Anyways, so The Rickshaw Man tells the story of a man named Muhumatsu, a.k.a. Wild Matsu. You know, he's got a reputation around town when we first meet him. The movie even starts off with a police officer going to a nearby inn looking for Matsu, who has just returned after being exiled for the last 3 years. And it turns out the reason he's looking for Matsu is because Matsu got in a little fight with a customer the night before, and he's currently on the second floor of the inn nursing a head wound that he got from the local constabulary's the local constable's kendo master,
right? Yeah, his kendo master.
Yeah, he gets out of that cart after, or he doesn't get in the cart. He tries to force Matsu to give him a ride, and he doesn't want to pay Matsu's price. So Matsu takes a swing at him, and this man responds by taking out his wooden kendo sword and smacking him directly on the head. So that's, you know, that's kind of giving us this comedy feeling for this movie. I feel like if you just saw that part, you'd be trying to figure that this was just kind of a slapsticky, goofy thing. A little bit later, Matsu is just living his life. You know, he's a rickshaw driver and stuff like that. But he walks up to a place where they're having the local kabuki theater, right?
Yeah. The beginning's kind of hazy to me, because I remember not really liking the first few minutes.
Yeah, well, it doesn't... The beginning part is only to establish that this man used to have a pretty rough life. And then it basically changes shape after this next scene, which is... Matsu goes up to the ticket taker, says, "Hey, thanks for letting me in." You know, just tries to walk in. The guy's like, hey, you can't just go in. It's like, actually, I don't know if you noticed, but I'm a rickshaw driver for this city. And the guy's like, yeah, okay, I realize you're a rickshaw driver, and normally I would let you go in. Matsu's like, oh, it's not for the likes of me. Okay, well, I'll just come back later. So the next day, Matsu and I believe another rickshaw driver walk up to the ticket booth, get a couple of passes, walk up to the ticket taker, slap it in his face and be like, "We're going to see the show now." And he says, first class guests. Okay. Yeah. Let those guys in. Right. Inside the crowded, what I call it, kabuki theater. Yeah,
kabuki.
There are where the floor panels would have been are now little booths that people can sit in. And Matsu and his friend proceed to start cooking something in a pot. Now, I did think it was weird that he was doing this, but not so weird that it wasn't something that wouldn't have been done. It just seemed, you know, I hadn't seen it before. But it turns out that they're putting in tons of herbs into this boiling water pot and all that stuff like that. And he's got a bunch of garlic ready to go. And Matsu lifts up the pot and says, "Puts the garlic on." He throws the other guy throws the garlic on the fire, which starts to produce a horrendous smell. Everyone in the audience is freaking out. "Oh my God, what is that? No, you're not supposed to be doing that. This is disgusting." You know, the officiates come out and be like, "What are you doing? Why are you making the smell?" It's like, "I want to cook. I'm going to cook here and no one can stop me. You don't like the smell? Too bad." Which eventually comes out to five people coming out, starting to fight Matsu and his friend. Yeah, they get pretty rough. Like, people get blood on them, you know, they're smacking each other with, like, wooden beams and stuff like that. It's an all-out brawl. And the reason why is Matsu is getting revenge for the snub that he got from the day before. Eventually, all the fighting suddenly stops when a man comes out, and this is the guy that's been in the Ozu movies. Chichu Ryu. Yeah. And he says, you know, people immediately recognize him. I didn't put down what his name was. Let's see. Chichu Ryu. They say something about him being like a very important architect or something like that. I got the feeling that he was like almost a magistrate or something, because he had full authority of the room, including Matsu, who, when he came in, he didn't know exactly how to react. And he goes straight up to Matsu and he says, I know that you're fighting and stuff like that, but I think that I've got a better way for us to work with this. If you'll calm down and come with me." He's perfectly reasonable with Matsu, and Matsu is just not used to that. He's used to being spit upon and ignored. So, yeah. taken aback, the next scene we see is this magistrate with Matsu, Matsu's friend, and the ticket taker. The ticket taker is looking like he looks really upset, and it's because he got shamed by the magistrate guy. Because it is literally, I mean, it's not a rule, it's just expected. If a rickshaw driver from this district, from this province, comes to a show, they get let in for free. And that's just the way it is. So, you know, you screwed up. You need to apologize. So he does apologize to Matsu. But the magistrate then looks at Matsu and says, "Now, I know why you did what you did, and I understand. But all of those audience members were the victims of your anger, and they did not deserve what you did to them. So I want to know what you think you need to do to make it up to them." And Matsu is almost brought to tears, and he just goes down on his hands and knees, and he apologizes to the group. You know, he's very upset, and his friend is also apologizing. It's like this one moment was all he needed, this moment of like kindness and understanding, to show him the error of his ways. And there's the magistrate says, you know, like, "Oh, I'm so glad it turned out that way. Bring in the sake." And then we see a line of like 20 women. And I was like, what's going on here? But it's just a transition shot. We don't actually, other than seeing the women come in with all the booze, we don't see any resulting party or anything like that.
Although Flair brought up that Matsu doesn't like to drink.
Right. So I think that at that time he was okay with it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until later that he, like probably after this transition, but I'm not sure. We certainly don't see him drink until later in the movie, not even in these early parts. He just loves udon.
Yep, love those noodles.
He's a real Naruto. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any Naruto?
Yeah, of course. Okay, I was in middle school once.
Oh, see, I was in college once, so.
I had an excuse. I was 13.
Oh, I've only seen like the first like two or three episodes, and I was like, this kid loves noodles.
Yeah.
Anyways, we transition forward in time. The rickshaw's spinning wheel. At this point in time, we just see Matsu working as a rickshaw man, you know, taking customers and stuff like that.
And he happens to be a taxi driver.
I mean, people know what a rickshaw is, right?
I don't know if they're listening to this show, probably.
Well, describe it for me.
It's like a basically a human-powered cart, but instead of the cart, it's like a fancy seat with cushioning. And the rickshaw will take the customer to wherever they need to go, like a taxi. Right.
And I think that Japan, or maybe even China, is kind of synonymous with the idea of rickshaws. Like, I certainly remember knowing what they were when I was, like, a kid, because it was, I don't know if it was a cartoon thing or possibly something associated with racism. I'm not sure. You never know with a childhood memory and a different country. Anyways, we see Matsu just doing his job, and he passes by a bunch of children who are up in a tree. And there's one child down at the bottom of the tree who is, he's very emotional, he's very sad, because his friends are making fun of him for not climbing the tree. And Matsu takes a moment to go, "Hey, kid, just climb that tree, man. It's cool." The kid's like, you know, for all we know, that kid doesn't climb that tree, except for the fact that later Matsu goes by the same tree, and all the children are running away from the tree going like, "It's not our fault. It's not our fault." And at the bottom of the tree is this young boy that he told to climb. And he's, you know, he's crying because his leg is hurt, and he bounced on his head or something like that. This kid's name is Toshio.
Yeah, Toshio. Not Toshiro, Toshio.
Toshio. So Matsu picks up Toshio, and he takes him back to his house where his mother, you know, is there waiting. What is his mother's name?
I put them as boy, mom, and dad.
It's Yoshiko.
Yoshiko, yeah.
Yoshiko.
No, wait, no, that's her last name.
No, her name is Yoshiko Yoshioka.
I thought their last name was Yoshiko because of...
Oh, okay, maybe her name is Yoshioka.
Because later on, like, you know,
Oh, no, yeah, okay. Her husband's name is Kotaro Yoshioka. So Yoshioka is their last name. I mean, like I said, her last name is literally, according to IMD, one letter different than her first name. Takes the kid back to the mother. Mother asks him if he can go get a doctor. So Matsu runs off and gets a doctor real quick. And you can already tell that Matsu is different than he was in the first two scenes. He's acting, you know, in this sense of concern. He's taking responsibility. It doesn't seem like he's the angry person that he was. And so we flash forward a little bit longer. The kid now has, you know, his leg is wrapped up and he's got a bandage on his head. And I believe at this point his father comes home, and that's Captain Kotaro.
Yep.
Who is very happy that this person helped, although the wife didn't get his name. And she says, Matsu refused money, so... Like, I didn't even get to pay him. And this is one of the many times where they just do a very short flashback scene. And how many would you say is in this movie?
Probably about 6, maybe?
I'm thinking more like 8 or 10. There are a lot.
I stopped counting at a certain point.
Yeah. They kind of do that Wayne's World, you know, squiggly line.
Yeah, it's like something falling into water. It ripples.
I feel like I've seen an SNL skit where people were like, yeah, I remember it like it was just the other day, and then yeah. So Captain Kotaro comes home. He talks to the kid. He's like, so, did you cry? And the kid's like, no, I didn't cry. Like, oh, I heard you were crying a lot. It's like, I cried a little. Mm-hmm. You're a little crybaby. I hate you. And he doesn't say I hate you. But they do... They do talk a lot about how this kid is not tough enough, and he cries a lot.
Yeah, and the mom frequently
right
tells
in front
him
of
to
this kid.
Man up.
Yep. Like, I don't know if he's going to be strong enough. I don't know if he's going to be a man. Like, geez, that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, it's kind of the mom's fault for pushing him too much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And at the when he's older, and there's a scene where she's still very worried about him, like, but you were pushing him to be stronger. I don't understand. But, you know, we'll get to that part. Mm-hmm. But Kotaro eventually, while talking to Yoshiko, he figures out that Yoshiko overheard that the man's name was Matsugoro. And at this point, we do move a little bit forward. Matsugoro is invited back to the house you know, for a proper thank you from the captain and his wife.
They're having dinner. Well, it's just after dinner, actually.
Right. You know, talking about the boy, you know, he's going to be strong, you know, what's going on. Captain Kotaro says, oh, you know, I'm feeling kind of tired. His wife's like, oh, are you okay? You know, do you need to lie down? He's like, no, I'm fine. Gets him a pillow, he lies down, he's like, it is freezing in here. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's really hot. Well, you know what that means, audience.
Yeah.
You know exactly what that means.
And
the next scene, we're at the graveyard.
Yeah, that's a very efficient way to deal with that.
Yep. We didn't want to hang out with that character anyways.
Yeah, but during the dinner party, Matsu is serenading him with a song.
Oh, yeah, Toucher is singing his heart out. He's doing a great job.
Is that the song later in the movie that the kid sings?
I'm not sure. I wasn't paying that much. Like, I don't think he named the song, and the other one has something to do with a flute.
I wrote down somewhere, the flute one.
Other than the lyrics, that certain type of Japanese singing that they do in these movies is very similar to each other. You know?
Yeah.
I'm sure that they have different tunes, but they, like, it's made more as, like, a storytelling vehicle than a song for, like, rhyming or enjoyment or something like that.
It's, part of the no drama, NOH drama, like, tradition in Japan.
Right.
And Kabuki kind of adopted that too, and
I understand.
I think. Yeah, I've taken a couple history classes in college.
Oh, that's cool.
And my teacher was, his specialty was Japan and China. So he made a point to make sure we covered Japan right.
Well, no doubt he told you about the Japanese-Russo war that they referenced very briefly in this.
Yeah, we did. We did get that far. We kind of stopped there.
Okay, because I know nothing about it.
Basically, Russia was on a decline. The monarchy system was failing, and this was Nicholas II was already in power, and so he basically, to prove that Russia was still a viable power, declared war with Japan. It lasted a few years, and Russia's massive navy was crushed because of they just had horrible government infrastructure and weak commanders and badly trained soldiers, and the Japanese was this very recent new small empire, not empire yet, but
organized.
Yeah, they were more organized and more focused, and they defeated this great European power. So for Russia, it was kind of the like part of the downfall into the Bolshevik Revolution. For Japan, it was a huge morale, morale victory, and it proved to the world Japan was a real power and not just a, you know, one of those countries.
Yeah. Not like China. That got conquered by Russia. Not really.
Well, China's a different story.
So, yeah, at this point, Captain Kotaro has passed away, and Matsu takes a pity. He takes pity on this poor woman. No, he doesn't. He takes a pretty big role in the widow and her son's wife. Life. Okay. He takes a big role in the widow and her son's life. He begins, you know, hanging out with the boy. He spends a lot of time, like, gardening for the widow and running whatever errands she needs. And, you know, he gets paid. They pay him and stuff like that. So he's doing the best he can. He's not educated, but he loves to watch the boy in school and stuff like that.
Yeah.
He does have a huge effect on the boy's life. Like he teaches him to be bolder, to say what he's thinking instead of just standing in the back.
Before the flashback to when
I was just going to say that. Yeah, earlier before the captain, it might have been before the captain died, or I can't remember. But
wait, it's before.
Yeah, Matsu is sitting at home. Sorry, what were you going to say?
Because I just wrote down his boy in my notes. But he is crying about the injuries, or just crying because that's just how he is. And Toshiro tells the story.
He comes into the house, and Matsu's got these like wounds all over his legs.
Yeah, from the job?
That's what I would assume, except for when the boy asked him where he gets it, he said, "Oh, I only get these when I take a day off." So I'm like, wait, are those like sores from sitting for too long? I don't think so. I think he's just being a goofball or whatever.
Yeah.
But he's like, "So are you still crying? Are you still a crybaby?" He's like, "I never cried." You're like, "What? You never cried before?" He's like, "I never cry." Like, come on, there has to be a time. He's like, "Okay, there was one time I cried.
My stepmom's one time I cried for a long time." Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like, "My stepmom's being mean to me," or something.
Yep.
And so he walked several miles as a child.
Yeah.
Where he should have died at some point, but nope, he somehow survived and reaches dad, because dad was like a miner or something.
He said that his father was in town to get feed for horses for the military for something. A town that was 10 miles away. Yeah, so he just kept walking. There's a part where he thinks he sees ghosts.
That part is kind of scary.
It's well done. Yeah. I liked it a lot. Yeah. And when he finally does reach the place where his father is, he just starts crying.
And his dad is real embarrassed and tells him to quit embarrassing him.
Yeah.
And then cut back to present, and Matsu is like, and I cried myself to sleep that night, and he's just having a big old laugh.
Yeah, for him, it's a funny memory, but one of the details of this is that if his father was off doing some sort of work thing, he was at a bar when he met him, you know, he was out getting drunk with his friends. And it is later stated that his father basically died of alcoholism.
Yeah.
So he didn't ever want to be like that. We keep flashing forward in time. You see the, like I said, we keep showing the wheels of the rickshaw and his feet, you know, moving in the background. It's all slow motion and stuff like that. Just transitioning between times. We get to a point where it's like sports day at for the town or at the school or something like that. I'm not sure.
I thought it was like the Navy.
Yeah, I'm absolutely not sure. It's not a thing that we have in the West at all.
The uniforms looked more Navy to me.
Because, there's teams that are doing some sort of weird wrestling thing where they're wrestling each side to get to the other side or something like that.
I've seen this before, like on a YouTube thing. Isn't Japan crazy type video? Where it's like the two poles and it's two teams, and I guess there's something on top of the pole, and someone from the opposing team has to climb up the pole, but you have to get through a massive crowd.
So it's like capture the flag or something.
Yeah.
Except for like some of the team goes and tries to get the other flag, the other team stays and defends.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
It's really looks really frustrating.
Yeah. But, Matsu's, like, yelling, telling him what to do, and the boy's embarrassed. He's like, no, you shouldn't be yelling. You're making a scene. He's like, okay, I won't yell anymore. And then these people run around, and they hand out these flyers that say the next event is, a run, 500K or something.
Yeah.
Stupid. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I believe kid reads it to him.
This is where another, like, okay, I understand if, like, you went to go see, like, a sporting event, like a track meet or something like that. But this is like, hey, anyone can join.
Yeah.
I haven't been one of those.
But doesn't the kid read it to him? Because he's illiterate?
He has the mother to read it, yeah. She says that anyone can join in. And the kid's like, oh, are you going to join in? He's like, oh, should I? Okay, I will. So Matsu gets out there for the race. And before he goes, he tells the kid, I'm going to try to win this, but the only way I'm going to be able to win is if you yell really loud for me. So the race begins, and Matsu is running, and he's got a very goofy running style because he's used to running while he's pushing the cart. So he's kind of, he's doing these, like, long strides with his legs, and he's got his arms kind of akimbo, but they're also moving because they got a swing.
Yeah, when the race starts, everyone is sprinting except for him.
Right. Yep. Slow and steady. He does, like he said, he does this for a living. Yeah. These people just think if I run as fast as I can, I'll win the race.
And it's 500 meters, which
there we go.
I don't know what that is. I don't know the conversion math.
Oh man, my father's gonna be mad at me. He's he was a track coach for years.
You should know.
Well, if you took a look at how I actually look, you'll know that I don't know shit about track. So, anyway, the crowd's kind of cheering. There's, in fact, one guy who's like, hey, it's Wild Matsu. Man, get out there. I'm cheering for you. You got to win. So, what is the kid's name again? Toshio. Toshio stands up and he starts cheering. He's cheering, Uncle Matsu, you can do it, Uncle Matsu. And sure enough, Matsu ends up winning the race, getting the first prize, which I think is some sort of suitcase.
Matsu.
Everyone's.
Yeah. Oh. Mm-hmm. And Matsu does not want the gift. He wants to give it to Toshio.
Yep, he says Toshio could use it when he's a grown man and leaves it with the family. But yeah, it's a big moment. Toshio learns how to speak up. He learns that cheering and being excited is okay. Don't have to hide your candle under a bushel. No.
That line and, from it?
No, oh. that's like a church song.
No, that must be a one. I never heard of that in Catholic church.
Oh, they don't teach you good songs in Catholic church. What are you talking about?
That's very true. We get boring Gregorian. Never mind. It doesn't matter.
Let's take down the Catholics in this episode. All right. Dressing down just for you guys. We transition forward in time again. At this moment, Matsu is hanging out with Yoshiko and Toshio. There is a brief moment where we see Matsu as like every once in a while is just watching the boy in school. Mm. We show that he's learned to speak up because he's like reading very loudly and clearly from the school book to the class. And they're going to have a... What does he call it?
It's basically a talent show, but it's
right. Not... But everyone seems to have to do something, so
yeah. It's like a performance day. And Toshio's like,
"I'm gonna, performance day." There we go.
I guess that's what it was. Yeah.
I mean, who knows what it's actually called? This is translated for a Western audience.
Yeah.
And he says, Toshio's like, "I'm gonna sing this song," and he's like, "Oh, that song, I know that." You know, he sings a little bit of it, and. Toshio is, you know, like, I can't remember how it comes about, but basically they make Toshio stand on top of a table and sing for them.
Yeah, Toshio says he's going to sing for them, then gets too nervous.
Yeah, at first he gets really nervous.
His mom says, "Be a man."
Yep, stop being a pussy, be a man. I hate that word, I should not have said that, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'll edit that out.
No, okay. It's fine. It's a word that people use, and I think that it shouldn't, including what I just said. But trying to be funny.
But back to the point, the mom.
You know what I mean.
Yeah. And the mom is still really pushing her son too hard. And
yeah, I mean, she in my defense, she is just really trying to get worried that her son is going to turn out to be a wimp for some reason.
Oh wait!
I guess because he fell out of a tree.
Yeah, we forgot to mention that the dad earlier takes a liking to Matsu and tells him he would have made it to general if he was in the military.
Yep.
Which doesn't feel like just me in this conversation. Like it feels very genuine that like he would have made a great soldier. Just kind of never was an option for him.
Yeah. That's weird, isn't it? Like, you have to have... you have to be, like, in a well-to-do family to be in the military?
I guess for Japan that time, it wasn't like he was to sign up. I guess it was other things, too. Like, maybe a military academy you had to pay for or something?
Yeah, that's true.
I imagine money was the barrier for him.
That makes, you know, for probably a smarter altogether military, since they, you know, people with more money had better educations.
That is true.
And maybe that's why we lost World War II. Yep, so Toshio performs for Mom and Matsu, Uncle Matsu, and then it just transitions into him being on the stage in front of everybody, belting out the song with all his heart. Doing like a really good job, and Mom and Uncle are sitting in the auditorium with everybody else.
And when you cut to the audience, you see, Matsu is like this, the clearly most excited person in the whole room, and everyone else is kind of like just watching performance. But it sounds like he might, it's kind of creepy, but it's not. He just genuinely is very happy that.
Right. At this point, he probably feels like this kid is his son almost, you know? Yeah. He's taken such a big part in his life ever since his father died. And it gets brought up several times during the movie, like, oh, don't you have feelings for this woman? Isn't he going to try to hook up with this woman? Like, there's a part where the widow's brother and his wife come to town to basically ask her, A, if she's going to move out of that house, or B, if she's going to get remarried. And she says no to both. She's sure of it. And her sister-in-law is a real biatch, by the way.
I barely remember them.
She was just like, oh, we wasted our time coming out here. Oh. Come on, let's go. I'm like, Jesus. Yeah. But that's kind of a thing. Like, everyone is asking, everyone's talking about it, but it's not something that comes up for Matsu.
Yeah. Or, it feels like Akiko from End of Summer.
Right.
A little bit, where it's just like it's just not important to them.
Yeah, it's more important to them to have their child succeed than it is for them to find somebody else. Although Yoshiko, when her husband does die, she does say that she's worried that there isn't going to be a good male influence,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the reasons why Matsu steps up in the first place. But I think it's at this point where we do flash forward even farther into the future.
This one, he's a teenager?
Yeah. And he's plotting with his friends. His friends are talking about how we're going to meet up with this other group and there's going to be a brawl. Although they don't straight out say it at first, but that's obviously what they're saying. And Toshio. Babubu. The kid is saying, you know, like, oh, I don't know if I should go. My mother's worried. You know, she gets worried about this kind of stuff. Like, say you're going to go. You know, don't chicken out. We're going to be there. You're going to be with us, aren't you? And finally, he agrees that he's going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes back inside. He puts on his school uniform with the black jacket and the hat. And his mother knows something's up because she was kind of eavesdropping. And she says, I have a feeling something terrible is going to happen. Please don't leave, you know, don't go out there. And he's like, Mom, I'm going to be fine. I'm a grown man, you know, I can leave. And I don't know about you, but I was like, oh, man, this kid's going to die.
Yeah, I assumed he was going to get killed or shot or something.
It's going to be that kind of movie. And so Yoshiko goes and finds
Matsu,
who is just hanging out at home.
Yeah, I think this is the first time you see her approach him.
Right.
Because other times she's very, just treats him like the help, more or less.
Yeah. Yeah, he goes around there to help whenever, and she just kind of stays at home, it seems like. And she goes and says that I'm just worried that something's going to happen to him. He said he's going to. And Matsu is treating this like it's a great thing. Like, oh, he's going to get into his first fights. You know, this is good for him. Like, this will toughen him up. And she says, well, can you just go and make sure he doesn't get in too bad of trouble? And he's like, okay, I will go and watch. So there's some big parade thing going on.
Yeah.
That is what was going on. And I don't know if they're just using this as a cover or what.
I think it was a cover. Or maybe they were in a parade. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So they're marching with the other students in the parade, and then these other kids that they're going to get into a fight with, I think, are students from a different, like, district or whatever.
Yeah, it's the rivals.
You know the Wakes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like...
You've seen anime?
Yeah, it's like, my rival high school was Lake Forest.
Yeah. Used to get in fights with them all the time.
No, the other redneck trashy school we did. I went to the smart kid public school.
So, anyways, there's a parade going on. Matsu's kind of hiding in the back there. And finally, these two groups of students meet up somewhere. And they just start beating the crap out of each other, like throwing mm-hmm. each other around, punching each other, all this stuff like that. There's one student who, like, strips off his shirt and stuff like that. And he's, you know, he's not ripped or anything like that, but he kind of looks like...
It's like that skinny ripped.
Yeah, like, he's a skinny Bruce Lee type, you know, like he obviously is into fighting.
Yeah.
And he, like...
Like no body fat, just muscle.
Yeah, Yeah. He grabs Toshio and kind of throws him aside, but Toshio is like cowering. He is not having this. And he sees Matsu and he goes, "Uncle Matsu, please save me." And Matsu is disgusted. He goes, "You coward. You're going to cry over here? You know what? I'm going to show you how this is done." And he takes off his shirt and he goes in there and he starts beating up a whole bunch of students. And I guess we're supposed to be cheering for Matsu.
I guess.
Yep. Even the skinny buff looking kid just is no match. He's throwing them left and right. He's just kind of standing in the middle while they all run at him. He's knocking them all over.
Well, Matsu is a middle aged man who, who is experienced with fighting, and these are children.
He knows what he's doing when it comes to that. And at this point, we transition again. There's no lesson learned from this, as far as I know. I'm not sure. Other than maybe listen to your mother.
I guess.
And, yeah, the next transition is that we're already ready to send the kid off. You know, I don't know if he's going to college or just going to school farther away.
So talking about, like, taking the entrance exam.
And he has to, you know, he's... This is already when he's, like, getting ready to leave, right?
I think... Wait, are you talking about when she asked him to carry his stuff to the train?
Yes.
Yeah, he's about to leave.
Oh, okay, so what happens is, first, he's walking with his friends. And Matsu is down by the river, and he's, like, he's washing his clothes or something like that. And he sees Toshio, and he says, "Hey, Sonny boy, where are you going?" And his friends start making fun of him, so he doesn't respond.
Yeah.
And, he complains to his mom, like, I'm a grown man, you know, he shouldn't be calling me Sonny, blah, blah, blah. And, when Matsu comes over to get the suitcases to take him to the train station, Yoshiko says, "Can you not call him Sonny? You know, he doesn't like that." Like, "Oh, he's growing up so fast. I mean, what am I supposed to call him?" And she says, why don't you call him Mr. Yoshioka?" Like, "Mr. Yoshioka? Well, that makes it feel like we're almost strangers."
Yeah.
And that's where it kind of ebbs off there.
Yeah. And
next thing we see is him.
Well, that scene reminds me of something that Reagan did when he was in college. He, not if you know Ronald Reagan, but he grew up in a poor family, and he was like the only kid of like six or seven or something that was a lad that could go to college.
Yeah.
And when he'd see his siblings, when he'd hang out with his rich college friends, he would ignore them. Even if they, like, approach him, he would just act like he didn't know who they were.
Nice.
You know, because Reagan was a piece of shit.
Don't say that too loud. It'll break your windows.
No.
I don't know who they are, but they will.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, we see him running the suitcases in his rickshaw to the train station, and while he's running, he's repeating Mr.
Yoshioka.
He's like, trying to get used to the idea in his mind as he's running along, but like we said, this he's basically raised this boy as his own.
Yeah.
You know, he never lived with the family or anything like that, but I'm sure he saw him, you know, almost every day for most of his life.
Yeah, he raised him.
And we see the train leaving with Toshio already on there, going off to this school, which I assume that he must have got into. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's not really discussed really at all.
Yeah, but Matsu makes some crack to Yoshiko that, like, "Oh, you're not going to know what to do with yourself now that he's out of here," you know. And Yoshiko is like, "Yeah, it's going to be really sad, but this is what's best for him, so I'm going to be, you know, strong for him." And it's like, this is at the point where we don't have much joking left here.
No.
Like, it is actually starting to get kind of sad here, because we're moving on. But it also seems like without Toshio there, Matsu doesn't have a real place to be in this house. You know, Yoshiko occasionally wants garden work done if she's going to have guests and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But you do get the, you know, you get the feeling that he is not coming around nearly as much as he did. You know?
Yeah.
And like you said, she doesn't go and visit him normally. She's only done it on one or two occasions. So we see, at this point, I believe this is where we see Matsu at a bar getting drunk.
Yeah, and this is when he says his dad was an alcoholic.
Right, because somebody makes a crack that they never see him in there drinking. He's like, well, he never did drink until now. So Matsu's not handling this transition very well. And one of his goofball friends that we saw earlier in the movie is like, so how come you haven't got yourself a wife? Yeah. You know, what about that lady you've been hanging out with?
And I think this guy was also a rickshaw man earlier.
And no, he was the guy that had the accordion.
Oh, yeah. But, like, he had moved up in life, and he has, you know, went from the lower class to, like, the upper class.
Yeah, he's got his own business. And he's got three people working for him. He's got a wife and like two kids and another one on the way. Yeah.
And so, like, this shows that everyone around him has changed, but he's stuck.
He has changed, but he hasn't
moved up.
In a different way, he hasn't, you know.
Well, like,
and
in terms of, like, class and, like, society, he is exactly the same as he was.
Right. He's got a real complex when it comes to that. Like, he thinks not only does that he is stuck in the lower class, he thinks he is lower class. He thinks he's not worthy of, like, the happiness and exception that he's gotten from this family that he's become a part of. And he like I said, when Toshio leaves, he takes it really hard. The guy makes a crack. Yeah, like I said, he makes a crack about, like, when are you going to get yourself a wife? And Matsu points at this poster with a woman on it for an advertisement for sake. He says, can I have that poster? And bartender says, sure, why do you want it? He's like, well, if I'm going to have a wife, I might as well have that one. That's the most perfect woman, you know. Mm-hmm. And I we're supposed to get the feeling that it kind of looks like Yoshiko.
Yeah, I got that too.
Yeah. And the next scene we see is Yoshiko suddenly appearing at his domicile, and posted on the wall there is just that sake poster. It's late in the day. She wakes him up, and he's like, oh, I'm sorry, I was up really late, you know,
taking
care of stuff. And he, like, tries to hide the poster from her. And she gives him the good news that Toshio is coming back into town, you know, for summer vacation or something like that. And he's bringing a professor with him.
Yeah. And is that weird that his professor visited him?
I don't think so. I get the feeling that is not nearly as unusual as it would be, like, for us.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's a big respect thing.
Like, yeah,
this is the man who is, he's a professor, he's a scholar, as far as they're concerned. And, like, oh, he's coming to visit the house, of course, yeah. And he's coming to town because he's heard about this great
festival.
Yeah, Taiko Drum Festival that they do. And, you know, Matsu's laughing off, like, oh, nobody plays the drums like they used to back in the day.
I was going to say the Gion Festival, but that's from a movie I watched today called Girl Boss Gorilla, which is a pinky violence movie from the 70s.
Pinky violence? What's that?
It's a subgenre of Japanese exploitation movies where pink or pinku basically means sex. And so it's like the sleazier side of things. Yeah, and there's a lot of topless women, but it's like very casual, like non-sexual nudity. And they have tattoos on their right breast, because that's a sign of you're in a gang.
Oh.
It's advanced level exploitation. I wouldn't recommend it if you're not used to sleazy movies.
Don't tell me what I can and can't watch.
Okay, watch it.
You're talking to the listeners, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, Toshio's coming back to town. And we transition to the big parade day. You know, people have balloons. We see candy being made and stuff like that. There's cotton candy wheels and stuff like that. It's almost like we're showing not only how much
time has passed.
Yeah, how much time has passed. Like how much the town has changed.
But shows how Japan has advanced.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the professor and Toshio come, you know, and are walking with Matsu to the parade.
Oh, did you see a snow cone thing?
Yes, the shaved ice.
Yeah.
Like, literally, like, the ice cube is on top of some sort of grating where they push the ice cube back and forth to get it. Yeah,
and you see his kid try it for the first time, and he's like, whoa!
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, me and my girlfriend would have a friend who has a toddler, and we gave her toddler cotton candy for the first time.
Yeah.
Which turns out was a bit of a mistake because she got too hyper.
Yep. Well, all it is sugar.
Yes. But it was nice to see her reaction to cotton candy for her first time.
Yeah. Oh, do cotton? She snorted it?
Yes.
Nice.
Gosh, goddamn young.
So Matsu and the professor and Toshio are standing there watching this parade procession, and there is one of those gigantic drums. And, you know, the professor's like, oh, yeah, I came here specifically to see. I heard all about the ceremony and the drum playing. And Matsu's like, well, this is nothing like the way the drum playing was back there. It's like, oh, well, I feel like I've wasted my time with you. See you later. No, he doesn't leave, but he is basically like, oh, that sucks. And Matsu's like, well, maybe I can go do it for them, you know? So he runs up to the float, or it's not a float, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's a...
And he's like, hey, can I play the drum? And the guy's like, yes, please, for God's sake. There are blisters all over my hands. Take over for me. So he does. He takes his drum and he like yells out like, this is this kind of drumming. And he starts playing it. And the band's playing along, you know. Mm-hmm. He's doing, you know, twirling the drumstick and stuff like that. When people perform, you see he's doing a really good job.
Yeah, he is stomping the yard.
Yep, exactly. Yeah,
he is. Bass got served.
Yep, yep. He's got
drum line.
Cheerleading, not cheer losing.
Yeah, he's like Nick Cannon in Drumline.
Yeah. He's got a real... The faculty.
With Aaron's boyfriend, Elijah Wood?
Elijah Wood. Starring Jesse Spano. No, wait, that's... never mind. Yeah, and then he switches up. He disrobes one of his arm, and he's like, and this is called the Prancing Pony or something like that. He starts playing a little bit faster, you know, twirling more. The band's playing along. And then he strips even further down. And he says, and this one's called the Galloping Horse. And he goes, you know, even faster, spinning the thing. And then somewhere else in the village, an old man suddenly comes out and says, is that the Galloping Horse or whatever? And his son, I assume it's his son, goes like, oh, is that the one you told me about? He's like, yes, no one's played the drum like this in a long time. We should all enjoy this, you know? So they all just kind of stand around. And then he's like, and this is the, I don't know, something crazy. Yeah. And he starts playing the drum, like, furiously, playing it really fast.
Each new drum technique gets crazier and faster. And the whole time thinking, I think he's going to die.
That's exactly what I thought. I thought he was going to have a heart attack because he talked about that earlier.
But then it's like, he's the life of the party.
Yeah, the screen starts going psychedelic. We're seeing the balloons in the background again. We're seeing the crowd. Like, while it's all over, his image is put over their image. And then we see the once again, the rickshaw wheel going, but we still see the image of him playing the drum. And the professor, by the way, is dumbstruck. Like, this is exactly what he wanted to see. So, this is the last time we see Toshio, by the way. He doesn't even come back for the end of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Which is fine.
He's not needed. anymore. Right.
And after this charming moment, after this scene, we go back to Yoshiko's home. And Matsu is, as we said, he had a moment, you know, it's obviously, you know, he's shown his cards. He is actually in love with this woman.
Yeah, and he just can't bring himself to speak to her.
Yeah, so it's at nighttime, and he's over there sitting, you know, he's actually kind of afraid to go into the place, and she's like, come inside, you know, of course, let me talk to you. I want to talk to you and tell you about what's been going on and stuff like that. And she's just talking about how wonderful things are, you know, how happy she is for how her son is and stuff like that. And Matsu begins crying, and she goes over and asks, you know, why are you crying? What can I do? Is there anything I can do? And he runs into the house to the room where they have the photo of her late husband, mm-hmm. of Captain Kotaro. And he gets down on his hands and knees, and he says, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. She goes into the room, you know, and he turns to her, and she backs away. And he says, I have to leave. My brain is thinking dirty thoughts. Like, that's what he says. Yeah. He thinks, my brain is thinking dirty thoughts. And he runs out of there. I don't know how much later it is. It must not have been that later. But Matsu has become a drunk. You know, we had the transition with, once again, the rickshaw wheels turning. Matsu is just a wreck of a person. And, you have to read into it. You read in that he hasn't been back there since this happened. He hasn't seen them. He hasn't talked to them. He's just been drinking himself into a stupor. And we see him wandering through the snow from a place, and it's made to mirror the scene when he was a child and he was walking to go find his father, you know, 10 miles away in a different town. Mm-hmm. He's just walking and walking, and then eventually he collapses into the snow, and something like his life flashes before his eyes. We see a bunch of solarized images of people singing and balloons and other things. And then young Toshio's face is solarized, and then it breaks through and you just see his face the way it is. You see Yoshiko's face. And the next, we transition again. There are children outside playing in the snow next to the school. And one of them sees something and says, hey, there's a man over here asleep in the snow. And it's Matsu.
And he's not asleep.
He is not asleep. His hands are clutching in a way that looks like he was, you know, in extreme pain. And probably froze to death along with a heart attack, just like he thought. And now we're at the magistrate's house that we haven't seen since the beginning. And they're going through Matsu's stuff. And it turns out that every Christmas time, every winter time, mm-hmm. they were giving Matsu money, you know, as a thank you gift. And he never spent any of it. He kept it all. And so it's all there for Yoshiko, who is basically his next of kin. He has no one else. And then, wrapped into a blanket hidden away, they find that he has also placed 500... Is it 500 yen?
I think.
500 something, you know, away in two different accounts with her name and her son's name on it. And she says, like, I never got to thank him. He never accepted the thank you for all this time. And she runs to where he is presented. We don't see his body, but she calls his name, and that's the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And now you're going to tell me, why did that ending bring me down, Spencer?
Yes.
I mean, why do you think?
Oh, I thought it was like a more personal anecdote.
No. I didn't feel anything like that. I just... like, we had a transition. We didn't really get to know the wild Matsu person, you know. You had, like we said, we had those first two scenes where he's acting kind of crazy. But after that, he seems to be, like, on a redemption type of thing. The kind of thing that characters who are Catholic are always doing. Like, oh, I've got to redeem my sins.
Yeah, like
Daredevil, Batman.
Yeah. Batman. Whatever.
Yeah, he's a Catholic.
His God's money.
His God is the city.
Yeah.
The city of Gotham.
The cinematography in this movie was either, like, really, not, this is generic, but, like, really cinematic and, like, sweeping, or it was, like, very standard.
Yeah.
And, like, in the, I think the opening shot is this giant crane shot that, like, swoops around, like, goes down and, like, swoops into a building and then goes to, like, the, like, the main road. It's a really great shot.
Yeah. A lot of the stuff, I mean, the, like I said, the sports day stands out, mm-hmm. the parade day stands out, the ceremony with the drums that stands out there. They're like, it was like some days they were like, oh yeah, we're going to show off exactly how beautiful this place is. There was one scene that I totally forgot when uh-huh. Toshio was still young after his father had passed away and his mother had asked Matsu uh-huh. to take care of him. Matsu is taking a customer on his rickshaw to a place and he passes by young Toshio who is sitting on the ground with a kite that strings are just completely tied up. Like, there's no way. So at first Matsu just kind of goes on and then he turns the rickshaw around, drops it while the guy is still in it, runs back and starts trying to untangle the kite for the kid. And the whole time the scene is done in like a wide shot. So Toshio and Matsu are on the right side up close towards the camera. And then in far focus in the back, actually slightly out of focus, we see the person that was in the rickshaw trying to call Matsu back, at first sitting in the rickshaw. Then he throws the blanket off. He gets out of the thing and he's pointing and stuff like that. And he's like, no, I need you. You know, he's not actually saying anything the whole time. He's doing this vaudeville routine.
Yeah,
and he's like hopping around. He runs around the thing. He ends up tripping and losing his hat. He tries to pick it up himself, almost falls over.
Yeah. It's a very like Buster Keaton or like Chaplin type thing.
It's extremely silly and really great, actually. And eventually Matsu's like, you know what? This is too complicated. I'm going to take the customer back. And then I'll come over here. The customer hears that, and he quickly gets on his equipment again and tries to get back into the rickshaw, but he forgets to put the blanket on. But he just sits there like, oh, no, I wasn't complaining or anything like that. And Matsu comes back, throws the blanket into the cart, and they take off again.
Yeah, it's a really great scene.
Yeah, it's great. Like, that could almost be like a little short film in itself. I'm complaining about the ending, but mm-hmm. I did really like the movie.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I watched it a couple more times. I'd really like it, but first viewing, I enjoyed it, but it felt a bit long to me.
Yeah. But like I said, we didn't even talk about all the flashbacks, because it's kind of hard to remember. Some of them were just like a 30-second flashback, and some of them were like an entire, like the scene where he was talking about the last time he cried, you know, that's a good 6 or 7 minute chunk.
Yeah. It's,
and then, yeah,
I don't know, like the first maybe 15 minutes or so I found really hard to get into.
It's a different kind of movie, the first part.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, I think that's the tonal shift in the beginning just really threw me.
Yeah.
Maybe. But I don't know, like, I just didn't really connect with this like I do with other, like, Toshiro-led movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's different. Yeah. Its tone is kind of weird. I'm like, you know, this boy being trying to force to be into a man, the Matsu never being like, at least in his own mind, truly accepted into the family. And, you know, the widow never making any sort of play about it because that's not proper, right? She probably doesn't even think there's anything there.
Yeah, I don't think she thinks of it at all.
Yeah. It's like a series of vignettes that tell Matsu's sad story. Yeah, and I find, you know, like that, like I said, that just makes the ending very heartbreaking, and I almost feel like it's not earned. Like, even though, yeah, we got to see all this stuff like that, I just don't feel like, oh, we were planning, by the way, we were planning for Matsu to die by the end of this, and like for him to die destitute and sad, feeling like he never accomplished anything or something like that. Like, this, why?
It felt out of left field, but not in a good, like, I'd say, like, lynching way. It's kind of like a, I don't know, like, why were you doing this? You could have done a different ending.
Yeah.
But also, this is a remake of a movie from 1943, also by Inagaki.
Oh. Enjoy the movie.
Yeah, it's good seeing Toshiro. It's weird, like, when we see Toshiro not with Kurosawa, he gets to show more range.
Yeah.
Where Kurosawa is like him being, like, a gruff, kind of grouchy anti-hero.
They emphasize, like, it's like, he's handsome. We have to make sure people know he's handsome. This movie was not about that. He was pretty grubby looking the whole time.
Yeah. And he is notably, well, he was still loud in parts, but he wasn't nearly as loud as he is in, say, like Seven Samurai.
Right. After the transition, yeah, he's not boisterous or anything like that, really. No, it's good.
Yeah, it's worth watching.
Yep.
It's Toshiro. It's if you see a documentary, Toshiro, The Last Samurai, narrated by Keanu Reeves, this movie was like what made him a huge, huge star. Like, Seven Samurai helped already, and Fortress helped, but then this helped them push him over the top because it showed he can do more than just action movies.
That's cool.
Yeah. And he got a lot of acclaim for acting, and this was a huge deal.
I think Hideko Takamine, who played Yoshiko in this movie, did a really good job also.
Yeah, she's a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
she's in,
I'm looking.
Oh,
she's in the Carmen movies. Does she play? She doesn't play Carmen, does she? Yes, she does. Okay, I've seen that. I've seen Carmen Comes Home, at least.
Yeah, she's in
The first color movie released in Japan.
Yeah, she's in a lot of Kimoshida stuff.
Cool.
She's in Kimoshida's Immortal Love, which won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film. I think she's in that one.
I've seen her in this movie, Carmen Comes Home, The Garden of Women, and Yearning. Which is a Makio Naruse movie. Oh, yeah.
Oh, she's in Wonder Woman Sends the Stairs, too. I forgot.
I haven't seen that yet.
It's good. You see Nakadai play a good guy, which is creepy and unsettling.
Doesn't sound realistic.
Then he kind of takes a turn later. But he's kind of a good guy for a while. It's like, this is creepy. But, let's see. There's not much else for really cover. Like, the heavy symbolism of the wheel reminds me of The Beguiled, where I love The Beguiled, but there's one shot that irritates me in that movie. It's towards...
Is it something with Clint Eastwood?
No, it's at one point, I talk about the remake, not haven't seen the old one, there's a shot of a spider web. And it's like, yeah, I get it. He's trapped there.
No.
It's stupid. It shouldn't have been there. Like it was pretty clear.
That you should have played that one song.
Anyway, one issue with The Beguiled, which is my favorite movie of this year. Just that
that's great.
One shot.
Let's talk about 1958 movies.
Yeah. Okay. I haven't seen this one, but it's called The Screaming Skull, and School of Shock covered it. And like,
yeah, you haven't seen it.
No, I just want to plug School of Shock.
Oh, okay.
They had a good episode on it. That's sure. 1958. But one I have seen is It, The Terror from Beyond Space. This is a 50s monster movie. You know what it is. But you have seen a movie that kind of copied it in a much better way called Alien. And the crazy Alien and crew, like, say they were inspired by this movie. And you see this movie, and it's the Alien, you're like, you see a lot of similarities, kind of like a not quite Yojimbo Fistful of Dollars level, but still pretty close in some ways.
Like Rotor to Terminator 2.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's clear like they flat out stole some stuff from It, Terror from Beyond Space.
Yeah.
But still,
I've not. Yeah, not seen that one.
It's worth watching. And there is a Kinoshita movie from this year that I tried to watch, but I kind of got bored with the story, called The Ballad of Narayama.
Narayama.
And the thing is, the set design is some of the best set design I've seen ever, where it's made to be like a you're watching a kabuki play. And so the set is evolving with when the scene changes, the set changes and evolves into something else. And it's this really beautiful look at, but it's not an interesting movie.
Yeah.
It's just that weird, or maybe it's just me, but that set design's beautiful, but just I couldn't get into the story or the acting or anything.
Well, maybe you need to watch some real crap, and then maybe I'll like it.
Yeah, maybe.
So you haven't seen much from 58, I'm taking.
No. Oh, there's one I just remembered. The Horror of Dracula. Yeah. The Hammer film with Christopher Lee, rest in peace, as Dracula.
I think that's what I was going to say. Although I don't know it as The Horror of Dracula, I just know it as Dracula, 1958.
Yeah, that's, I think, the only Hammer film I've seen.
Yeah,
and
me too.
It's all right.
Yeah, it's all right.
It's about as good as Herzog's Nosferatu. You know, it's all right.
I like how bombastic the coloring and the acting is, mm-hmm. but it isn't much. It isn't very interesting beyond those things.
Yeah, I don't get Hammer. Maybe I haven't seen the. Maybe I should see, like what. What's like, I don't know what the good Hammer movies are.
I don't know either. There's a million of them, though. Yeah. So
I was on impression like this was one of the good ones, but
that's what we're doing next: Hammer films.
Yeah.
So you haven't seen Vertigo?
No, I've seen like maybe three Hitchcock movies.
So we're doing Hitchcock next. That's right. Okay.
Yeah, probably because I have not watched anything from him really.
Yeah.
Vertigo has Stewart.
Yes. Jimmy Stewart.
There's no Cary Grant doing Cary Grant and not acting.
No. Kim Novak. Yeah. What?
So there's actual acting from the lead.
I mean, I guess.
I mean, Cary Grant, this, like in North by Northwest, is just doing his Cary Grant shtick.
Yeah, that's fine. It works out great.
I guess, but sometimes, like, it's like George Clooney. Just put a little more effort into it.
When Hitchcock casted that, he casted Cary Grant specifically. You know, he had worked with him before.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy Stewart heard that he was making a new movie, and he was like, so, if you're looking for a leading man, I'd love to look at the script. And Hitchcock didn't have the heart to tell him that he'd already cast the main role, so he waited until Jimmy Stewart was busy doing a different film. Mm-hmm. And was like, oh, we're doing the filming now. I'm sorry. He's like, oh, no. Uh-huh. And in later interview, Stewart is like, you know, the one thing that I regret the most is that I missed out on getting cast in North by Northwest. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, Hitchcock was messing with you.
But yeah. But Vertigo is one of the Stewart ones.
Yeah. I mean, I got a Vertigo story.
Okay.
I didn't see that until about 5 years ago, and I saw it on the big screen. I was ditching college.
All right.
And I went with my buddy Jose to go see it in the theater. And this movie's like number one on the Sight and Sound list and stuff like that.
Good night.
Good night.
No, it wasn't for you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, number one on the Sight and Sound list, and so we were, you know, we both like North by Northwest and the other, a bunch of other of his movies, so we're like, okay, we'll check this out. And I gotta say, we were kind of like, we were into it, we were watching, we're like, okay, but neither of us knew anything about the plot. We mm-hmm. didn't know any of the details, we had no idea what was gonna happen. So by about midway through, we were like, oh, I don't see what's so special about this movie. And then the first twist of this movie happens, and we were just like, what the hell? Like, all of a sudden, this became an amazing movie. And I think I would enjoy it more now than I was at the time, because even though I know, like, when the split happens, mm-hmm. it's just, like, it hit us so hard. We were not expecting it, and that's a really great experience. I wish other people could experience that, but in this day of the internet, you know, it's pretty hard, pretty hard to walk into something fresh.
I know nothing about it.
Okay, well, don't.
I heard a podcast on it like a year ago, but I barely remember anything from it.
No. So besides that, from this year, The Blob also came out.
Haven't seen either of the Blobs.
Well, the original 58 one has Steve McQueen playing a teenager when he's obviously like, he looks like he's 40-something. He's probably in his late 20s.
Yeah.
And it's really campy. It's fun, but it's not... I mean, it's not mind-blowing or anything like that. It's fun to watch. Fiend Without a Face, have you heard of that movie?
Yeah, it's been on my Netflix DVD queue for like a year and a half. I just keep moving it back for other stuff.
Yeah, I get the feeling that this was like a Mystery Science Theater 3000 movie, possibly. I don't know for sure.
It's on Criterion.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like one of the first movies rated X for like, because
well, it is gross. I can understand that
because the British film board felt it was too gory and violent.
Yeah, it's pretty gross. It is kind of violent, but I think it's really good. Like, I recommend watching it if you want to watch something that's short and just a fun watch. It's only 74 minutes long.
Hmm.
I think I watched it on YouTube, so I'm not sure. And I really haven't seen that many other movies from this era. Gigi, which I don't like.
Who's in that?
I don't know. Let's see.
Oh, is that Taylor?
No.
My phone's dead, so I can't look it up.
Leslie Caron, Marie Chevalier, Louis Jordan, nobody I know. Eva Gabor, that's the one name I know.
Okay.
The last thing I'm going to mention is that I've seen a couple of Agnes Varda's short films, and there's one called The Diary of a Pregnant Woman.
Mm-hmm.
60 minutes long. It's this, you know, it's an experimental sort of art film that just has somebody talking about their experiences of like being pregnant and what it's like. And they do a lot of nightmare and dream imagery. And it's a really good watch.
Mm.
Yeah.
Where is it watchable?
I think I watched it on Filmstruck.
Okay.
It might've been Hulu, you know, when they had the Criterion, but it's part of the collection.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it, other than a bunch of Looney Tunes.
Yeah. I'm looking up the next episodes.
All right. In the meantime, if you, the listener, think that I'm a very entertaining person and charming and handsome, I'm just kidding, how would you know that? You can also hear my delectable tones on the podcast, Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space. Every week we do a new science fiction and fantasy movie. The most recent one was on the movie Rotor, which was my choice, and is a fantastic freaking time. It's for free on YouTube, R-O-T-O-R. You should watch that immediately, and just be prepared to laugh. And pretty soon we're going to have a special guest, Gary Butterfield, from the podcast Watch Out for Fireballs, and what is the name of that? He does that Dark Souls, or he did do that Dark Souls podcast, Bonfireside Chat. He's going to be on to talk with us about the movie Willow. And we'll be celebrating our 100th episode pretty soon. I haven't quite figured out what we're doing about that, but that's coming up too.
You can do Alien or Aliens. Do something big.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, but I do like to keep those in case a guest wants to do something on that.
My phone just died, so I have to use the... If I use the internet while recording, it's weird sometimes.
Is it on the dock?
Yeah.
Yeah, let me look.
It says...
Kurosawa schedule.
Yeah, it's his first two movies, but I can't remember what they're called.
Hidden Fortress, Rickshaw Man, it's Sanshiro Sugata 1 and 2.
Yeah, because I don't want to look for other movies from those years, because I'm not sure there's any available.
Probably not. Probably not easy.
Yeah, so that's going... And also, those are considered to be his worst movies. And it's part 1 and 2, so why not just knock them out?
Yeah, I'll be the judge of that.
Yeah. They're propaganda films, and also they're like, I think it's about a kickboxer. They're also martial art films, apparently.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, but Kurosawa apparently hated them because it's propaganda. He didn't have control over his production.
I see.
And of course he made Uma, that horse movie. In quotations, made it.
It's co-directed.
Yeah. But that's kind of hard to track down.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sanshiro Sugata in part 1 and part 2.
Yeah, that'll be its one episode. Probably won't be long because I don't imagine there's much because it's a propaganda film. Yeah. So, I have it on DVD. Yeah.
So I said where they could find me. Where do they find you, Spencer?
I'll be on a grind bin in August. It is August now. I think so. Mike said August or September or something. They record. Anyway, the grind bin. Yeah, I'll be on grind bin in August or September. They record their stuff like a month and ahead, like 2 months ahead of time because they're always prepared.
Wish I could do that.
Yeah. And I was on School of Schlock, which I brought before. Talked about a kung fu movie I forgot the name of. just look up the episodes. I'm episode 26, I believe. And Semi-Knife Fight this month is... I'm reviewing Space 1999... Which is kind of like a BBC, not BBC, it's like a British-funded / American show. That's a 70s Star Trek, and the Captain Kirk role is Martin Landau.
Everybody knows who Space 1999 is.
All right. And, so, because Martin Landau died, I decided to use this review now, because I did it a while ago.
Sure.
With that, I'm prepared with stuff in advance. But yeah, this will be a tribute to Martin Landau, and he's really good in the show. Everyone should watch Space 1999. It's on Hulu. But you have to pay for Hulu to get it.
I'm sure you could find it somewhere.
Yeah. And that's it. You can listen to the outro stuff.
You can.
I have an outro tag thing I attached to it.
Oh, sounds good.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep.
So we're stopping recording?
Thug Life, Buffy Design.
Watermelon Party. Wait.
Pineapple Party.
Oh,
I had too much pizza for dinner tonight, so I'm feeling too full.
He's Logie.
That's it.
I was a rickshaw man. Okay, I'll come up with a better song next time. All right, bye.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show is available on the Google Play Store, Podiant, PODIANT, Podbean, as bean, not beam, and iTunes, and wherever you find your podcast. Thank you for listening. I was hurt. It just